being malnourished. So, you know, I don't know. It's one of those interesting things you can do in a lab and write a paper for. Should one of isoleucine, by the way, for people listening, is an essential amino acid for human beings. Failure to consume isoleucine will cause structural problems in building proper proteins and will impact quality of your life. So please do not do any of this. Again, if you're a mouse, feel free. Go crazy.
WB2EAV will comment.
Certainly, Ed.
If you want to extend your lifespan, how about, A, not doing stupid things that can kill you, B, not smoking or drinking to excess, and I guess the third one would be try to avoid combat zones. I don't think it'll lead you to a tremendously long life, but it certainly increases your odds of at least getting to the point that God designed you for.
I would agree with you. It's a very common-sensey sort of thing. Unfortunately, you might have noticed that human beings are highly irrational and tend to do all the terrible things that shorten their lives.
Okay, let me go to the next one because we have a few minutes left. Okay. So, new cases of Hanana syndrome grow. It was many situations reported by diplomatic personnel that they had a very much incredible vertigo, dizziness, head pain, or many other symptoms that happened in Havana and that happened in Russia and many other places. And of course, as we know what Dick was saying, inverse square law, even microwave from the distance of 1 mile being dangerous. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
60 Minutes Today had an item on it. Not terribly helpful, but brought it to the forefront.
Okay, 60 Minutes has done a lot of dubious reports. On my link page from about 2-3 weeks ago, I posted a link to an article that a retrospective study of all of the people who complained of Havana syndrome, none of them could be found to have any physical abnormality whatsoever. This, as I kind of mentioned many times in the past, is a wonderful example of the concept of hysteria. Hysteria does not mean the people are crazy, does not mean they're psychologically damaged or stupid or anything pejorative. People develop hysterical symptoms for things. And there have been many documented cases of sympathetic hysteria in the past, and this is just one in the present. I'm curious, Ed, was 60 Minutes pro, con, whatever, or just equivocal about Havana syndrome?
This still by science is seen as a mystery and not resolved, so we don't need to stay on it for long. Next thing is Mars, and 3.5 billion years ago there was life on Mars, at least it was something. Possibility, and it was Dr. Stephen Burnham from Imperial College London. Let me drop. I'm sorry, Ben. Did you hear me, Dr. Rose?
Saying it's hysteria.
Am I coming up?
Unfortunately, once again, Wesley and Ed were doubling with each other, and in this case, it wasn't a perfect 50-50 double. I pretty much heard what Wesley said, and unfortunately, the only time I heard Ed was when Wesley dropped the repeater. So perhaps, Ed, you can repeat yourself, and Wesley, you know, you just listen for a little bit, and, you know, try not to hit that push-to-talk too fast.
Okay, yeah, I'll do it again. On 60 Minutes, they interviewed a number of the victims. Now, here's what happens. They're saying, the consensus is, it is originated by Russia, it's being done by Russia and their allies, and they are targeting investigators who are going after them. So if you have a batch of investigators who are studying Russian spies and the like, that's a relatively narrow subset to find, you know, this tendency towards hysteria. I mean, these are well-documented cases.
Well, so are the hysterical symptoms that people had are well-documented, and a lot of it had nothing to do with Russian spies. I don't think the people hanging out in Havana at the very beginning, and when it was a problem in China, I don't think they had cozied quite up to Russia that much. So I think people are just kind of backtracing, cherry-picking, and coming up with something, which perfectly consistent. 60 Minutes has repeatedly taken this all incredibly seriously. One of our last conversations I had with Dick about it was based on a 60-minute presentation 1 hour before the technical net. So I think they're just demonstrating. I used to respect 60 Minutes about 20 years ago. I think they've kind of gotten a little loosey-goosey personally. But, you know, I mean, everyone is free to believe what they want to believe. Again, if you go to roy.ac2gs.com and go down to a couple of weeks ago, you'll see that there's a link to an article on all the medical findings seem to be non-existent. So I'm still in the hysteria basket. But, you know, I could be absolutely positively wrong.
I see the time is ending, so can I go? We have more stuff.
Okay, I think you kind of mentioned the water on Mars. Again, I heard you through the doubling.
Yeah, okay. So 3 to 3.8 billion years ago, there was plenty of water in Mars. And Dr. Stephen Burnham from Imperial College of London, he is mentioning about possibility of life, or great possibility of life, that was on Mars, and Earth at this time was starting, was also having a life form on it, so that was like both together were doing till Mars didn't start to lose the atmosphere, and then eventually dried out, and most of the water turned into the vapor and vanished in the space. So that's, I would like to have your comment on it, Dr. Ray.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. It's kind of what-ifing type of things. I don't know what it gets you. Maybe there was water, maybe there wasn't. His assumption is based on similarities of scientific research of Mars versus structures on Earth, which I don't know if you can correlate 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 or 18.5-to-1. So maybe there was water. If there was water, then maybe there was life. If maybe there was life at that point, you have to realize how many billions of years it takes evolution to come up with anything consistent. So chances are if 3 billion years ago there was some life on Mars, you'd need a microscope to detect it. So maybe, but maybe not. So, okay. He wrote up an article, and his university sent out for a public release, and so we're talking about it now. You know, what can I tell you? I'm not that enthused, firstly.
Yeah, I would agree with you, if not that the in the video that I had sent you, also there is a detailed description of the faces and architectural elements that allows him to determine the positional process of mechanics of the sedimental accumulation, reconstruction of the dune field, and determining paleoclimate and its implications and habitability. So he was pointing at a certain deformation and even bringing the pictures of the Earth structure versus the Mars structure and showing the similarities and differences on it. So I assume he is a PhD in geology, not geophysics, because geophysics is the science about geophysics is actually the tool for geology. Maybe Paul has some comment on it.
Any comment on that, Paul?
Okay. Actually, right now I'm reading a good book, and it really has to do with the geology of Mars. It's called Mission to Mars, of all things. But it's Larry Crumpler. He studied all this stuff for his whole life. You know, he's older now. And it's always, you know, speculation until it's proved. All these studies that they do, the beginning of science, the beginning of proof for science, all the studies that these guys come up with, the theories that they come up with, now it's up to the researchers and the scientists to actually prove, you know, that something really was there. Most likely, though. Most likely there was water there. Yeah, that's the way they're all going right now. I'm waiting for the day of proof. You know, they know that the Phoenix spacecraft had an arm on it, a little shovel type of thing, and it moved some dirt at one point, and all the shiny stuff was there, and they said, "Oh, that's like ice." But they didn't prove it until a couple of days later. They took another picture, and it was gone. It evaporated. So, you know, most likely there was water there. Whether there was life there or not, who knows? Life could have started there. Hit with a big asteroid, shot pieces off 50,000, 100,000 years before it gets to Earth, and then it starts on Earth. Or it could have been the other way around. But all these things have yet to be proven. Roy?
Yeah, a lot of questions, not a lot of answers. You know, I mean, some people don't really like the idea of alien life seeding the Earth. You know, they'll say that, okay, so that meteorite was exposed to intense heat on its trip through the atmosphere down. By the time it reached the Earth and splattered, it probably evaporated itself and seared any proteins out of existence. But who knows? You know, each day is another opportunity for discovery.
Okay. The next one. Tesla Cybertruck Funk is hungry for fingers. So if you happen to find yourself with the finger off limb in the opening of the Cybertruck trunk, you might be in for a world of hurt. What is happening is there is a trunk in Tesla that has very sharp 90 degrees edges, very much close to the windshield, but actually, yeah, the rear windshield, the rear glass, right? And in the picture, in the article that I have sent you, you probably didn't see that. You see that the person put the carrot in that place instead of his finger, and it actually ripped the carrot off. It's scary. It's very scary. Do you see that?
Are you imputing the engineering brilliance of Elon Musk? You know, he for that.
I mean, this is ridiculous. This is like waiting for somebody losing fingers or being hurt badly. Not even driving. It's absolutely horror. It's horror. Just click on the link which says Tesla Cyber Truck from Hungary. Click on that and you're gonna see that. It is show how the hood is closing.
Comment, WB2EAB.
Yes, sir, please comment. But I've mentioned before that the Cybertruck is a disaster waiting for a bunch of people to sue him. The stainless steel that doesn't, that stains, the angles that will kill any pedestrian it touches, it's a travesty of, you know, it makes the DeLorean seem like a brilliantly engineered car. Yes, sir.
If Tesla is smart, the minute they heard this, they jumped with both feet into redesign. Any other option, we're talking absolutely huge lawsuits. Because when you're finding out that they are doing irresponsible design that is hurting people, and they did nothing about it, that's when the penalty fines come in the billions.
Ed, are you familiar with Elon Musk?
We've seen this before. Not just Elon.
No, I mean, there's a lot of narcissistic lunatics out there, but he's a particularly apt one. He seems to get away with things. He has blown up more rockets in near environmental safe places than anyone, as far as I'm aware. He breaks rules. He hires very expensive lawyers, and most of the time, he gets away with murder. So do I expect the Cybertruck to be recalled and modified? No. I expect them to slow down the pace of manufacturing so that there's very few new Cybertrucks, and then one day he'll simply stop talking about them, like he did with the Roadster, which was supposed to be out about 5 years ago. And that'll be the end of that. And eventually, a bunch of people will sue him. He'll take them to court. Tesla will lose money. He won't. And life will go on in this wild, wild world of ours.
WS2N comment.
Certainly, Paul.
I wonder if you read this story about the Tesla that went into the water. It was the, I believe it was the Labor Secretary. Anyway, for the Trump administration. And anyway, her sister had left the house and threw it into reverse, hit the gas, and wound up in a pond, and far enough out into the pond where nobody could get to her. Police showed up. Tow truck showed up. Tow truck, the cable wasn't long enough to pull the car out. She's inside, and they're trying to get her out. And the window didn't open. Then they decide to try to break the windows. Turns out they made it out of some kind of a poly type of material. It won't break. The glass won't break. They're smashing it, trying to break the glass. It just won't break. I mean, that's a disaster. It's one thing they always tell you, you know, if you're drowning and you can't get out of the car, make sure you can find a way to break the glass. They even make little gadgets, you know, you can carry in your glove compartment to break the glass. This, apparently with this, the police couldn't do that. Anyway, she wound up losing her life. Back to you, Brian.
Yes. Yeah, I heard about that. It's a travesty. It was one of the selling points. I don't know if you remember, but there's a lot of footage of Tesla having some guy who's a member of the crew throw a ball or a rock or something at the windows and saying that they were bulletproof. Because his old weird idea is that the Cybertruck should be able to take a full-on military assault. So he kind of told them to build a thick-gauge stainless steel and bulletproof windows and all kinds of safety travesties. The Cybertruck can never be sold in Europe because the safety laws in Europe for a car like that violates almost every rule. So, I mean, I'm sure he's going to get sued again. This is just a bunch of suits waiting to happen. I don't see any way around it. It was a silly idea, badly thought out, and poorly manufactured.
And this was a regular Tesla, though, the one where she drowned.
Yeah, this one in particular was a regular Tesla. And I don't quite understand why he seems to expect World War III or something. Everything in the has to be bulletproof.
WA2, yes.
Yes?
Yes, good evening, everybody. I saw the video, and Tesla advertised the window was unbreakable, or someone threw whatever it was, and the window broke. So I think that that is a more accurate recitation of what had occurred when they tried to advertise the strength of that window. In addition, there are so many issues regarding quality control on those cars. They're absolutely, they're a golf cart with a big battery. There's just so many quality control dilemmas. Things don't fit right. Things don't work right. I think he did well initially, but he's got to work on it if it's going to be successful.
Okay, Stu. Well, in one demonstration, the guy threw something and it shattered and punched a hole through it, but it didn't completely destroy that paint. And later times, he modified the experiment where the guy was throwing some kind of a softball with a lot less momentum. So in those cases, he was able to prove that his glass is better than we thought. But it did. That particular glass did break under the first demonstration. People have been showing it repeatedly to make fun of the jerk.
Well, I appreciate the clarification. I don't know why anybody would dwell upon the shatterproof quality of windows when you're trying to sell cars. I would think you should appeal to a lot of other issues and to the people at large, not whether a window is impenetrable or not. That didn't make any sense to me. And I think also him smoking weed, it really turned off a lot of people. I just think that was a poor taste. But he is a genius, and I agree.
A slight tangent?
Yes, certainly, Ed. And by the way, I don't think he's a genius. Go ahead.
There is, I believe, at the Transportation Test Center outside Phoenix, Colorado, a cannon that shoots supermarket chickens at airplane windshields to make sure that if the windshield on a plane hits a bird, it won't come through, recognizing that's a very, very different application.
Gee, that must be an interesting job.
Was it a kosher chicken that you could even
do wild stuff?
Ed?
Yes?
Was it a kosher chicken? That might make a difference.
No, kosher chickens aren't in the budget. But in all seriousness, they've literally used supermarket chickens because to come up with a tailored chicken for the test would probably cost $10,000 per chicken.
Go to Costco for $5.
Yeah, but no one's cousin or uncle or brother-in-law is going to make a lot of money off of a contract like that. So I'm glad that people are thinking rationally for a change. So thanks for adding that, Ed. Wesley, I hope we've come to the end of your list because I really think it's time that we move on to the next segment.
Okay. No, just the last one for entertainment. Wi-Fi. What Wi-Fi term came from?
Okay. Offhand, I don't know. I'm sure anyone who wanted to could Google it. It never really, interested me enough. I've heard people regularly explain why Bluetooth is called Bluetooth, but I don't really recall anyone discussing Wi-Fi, although I think there was a recent article on that I skipped.
Okay. So it looks like we don't have the time. So Wi-Fi isn't the abbreviated version of wireless fidelity, as many people believe. Wi-Fi is a pun of hi-fi, which was coined in 1950s by audio equipment manufacturers and shortened version to high fidelity. But there is no such thing as wireless fidelity. So it was a snappy name invented by marketers. That's all. And to Asia.
It makes sense that they played on hi-fi, which was well known for decades.
That's all right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, and, you know, marketing is sometimes a good thing. You know, Bluetooth has very little to do with what a Bluetooth device is, but marketing thought it was sounded good, and it's a good branding. It, all these names are primarily branding names. There are usually associations that are formed. Partners approve different aspects, and they go out and license the technology and sell to all of us. So, thanks everyone. That was loads of fun. I enjoyed myself. I hope you enjoyed yourself. And now it is time for full WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Thanks, Roy. I feel like we did the SpaceNet Report earlier today, so this is like part two. You know, thanks to Rich's question. Yeah, going to the moon. No, I went back and I looked at one of the old nets and I found the power plants that they plan on putting on the moon. They, NASA calls it KRUSTY, KRUSTY. It just stands for Kilopower Reactor using Stirling technology. Stirling, that's that magnetic system I was telling you about. But, you know, from what I understand, they're going to have a fission, little fission plant. It's going to create heat, and it's going to move this weight back and forth, and you know, with creating a, you know, with coil in there, creating a magnetic field. And they're going to have a whole bunch of these, and each one is going to be 10 kilowatts. And the contract was for, you know, a 40 kilowatt system. So who's ever developing this for NASA is actually not fully involved with the development of it. They're looking at making four of these things. That's what it's called. You can look up KRUSTY, NASA, fission power for the moon, and you can see actually what the thing looks like. Let me drop it.
Paul?
WB2AV.
Yeah, okay, Roy, and then I heard Ed.
Yeah, Paul, you want to hazard a guess how many joules of energy a Saturn V rocket releases?
Let's see. So I know it's 7.5 million pounds of thrust with the five F1 engines, but I'd have to convert thrust. Usually they convert it to newtons, and then from there, I guess you would go to joules. How many joules?
Yeah, it's 8.4 trillion with a T, trillion joules.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Was it 1 joule is 1 watt? Per, no, I forgot how many times Dick used to say that. What's the definition of 1 joule?
I think it's watt per second, so a 100-watt light bulb every second uses up 100 joules.
Confirmed.
Okay, there you go. And the space launch system that launched the Orion to the moon, you know, unmanned, and in the near future, a crew of four to the moon and back. I believe it's 8.5 million pounds of thrust. So roughly a million pounds more thrust than the Saturn V. Then they have the SLS. They have a, they call it the one, well, the solid boosters that are attached to it. They're called 1B, and then there's going to be a 2. Anyway, I get two more versions down the road, which are going to increase the amount of thrust. You know, they'll be up to ultimately around 10 million of thrust by the time they're done redesigning the space launch system.
Paul?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ed.
You were talking about a 10 kilowatt fission generator. This sounds to me like a scaled-up version of the radioisotope generators they use on deep space probes because there ain't enough sunlight to power them. I mean, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, theory anyway, are still running on their original load of, you know, radioisotope fuel.
Yeah, I don't think these are RTGs. They're calling them fission. I don't know, an RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. you really call that a fission unit? I don't. You know, that's giving off, basically giving off heat that's surrounded by graphic blankets, graphite, like, trapping everything within one area, and then inside that they have all the thermocouples, you know, thousands of thermocouples. Some are parallel, some are in series, and they collectively come out with 109 watts of energy for each radioisotope thermoelectric generator. And there's three on board each Voyager. I don't consider them that a fission unit. This is actually considered a fission unit. Well, I use that word. I haven't seen any real exploded view of Krusty, but they, you know, they call it the kilowatt reactor using Stirling technology. But they're saying it's a four kilowatt fission system. But I'll have to read up more on it. You know, I know they have one running in some field out in some property that NASA owns, and they're testing it. It's been running, I think, a couple of years now. They just want to see how long it's going to last, I guess. Back to you, Ed.
Radioisotopes are definitely fission. They are radioactive. I remember when they launched Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 with their radioactive radioisotope generators, people were absolutely petrified that if something went wrong on the launch, it might spread radioactivity on the Earth. Thankfully, that nightmare scenario has never come to pass. But the point is, it is basically a lump of material that will stay at, like, you know, 500 degrees for like 50 years or something like that due to fission energy. And they just use, like you said, like, you know, Peltier junctions or thermocouples or what have you for taking the difference in heat between that hot lump, I don't know what shape it is, and deep radiating out to deep space. Then they use the temperature differential to generate enough electricity in case of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 to operate the spacecraft. This sounds like exactly the same thing except for the name.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to look into this new design. The old design, the RTGs, I've read a lot about them. They're 87.5 years half-life on the plutonium-238 that they use for the RTGs. And, yeah, they launched them on Pioneer spacecraft. They launched them on Voyager, of course, which is still operating, like you said. They launched it on the Ulysses spacecraft. That's the one that went around the north pole of the sun, the south pole of the sun, you know, in a polar orbit of the sun. They used it quite a bit. They used it. The one that where they were really going to protest was Cassini. That one really got a lot of attention. I think that's because it was launched right after that Russian plant blew up. But you know the Russian nuclear plant. Maybe because of that, they got more attention. And oh yeah, they were worried about that. And they showed how they tested the canister that it was in, and it's not going to blow up at all. Anyway, that was fine. That went to Saturn. And then you have the two of them riding around right now on Mars, RTG on Cassini, as well as the Perseverance rovers. They both have the RTGs. Ed, back to you.
Well, first, the name you were trying to think of is Chernobyl. Second, yeah, that's my point. But what I'm saying is, this item that you've described, they're saying it, oh, no, it's different. But what I'm hearing is exactly the same. Maybe a little bit bigger, that's all.
Yeah, but they're going to have to find new stuff, which I know they're working on, instead of plutonium-238, because they're out of that, or not out, but very little of it around to do, to deal with it. Yeah, I heard Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, apparently Stirling radioisotope generators use, I think, the same thing, plutonium, as the RTG. The method that it extracts energy, though, appears to be more efficient. They say that compared to RTGs, the same amount of plutonium, they can extract four times the energy from it.
You know, with time, things figure out more clever ideas. But it still is, you know, the same basic thing, a radioactive isotope.
Yeah, with a little bit of a technological twist to improve efficiency.
Well, I would hope in the 50-odd years they've been doing this, they've gotten better at it. But the idea is they work with thermal heat. It's just that this thing will stay hot for 50, 100, whatever years.
Yeah, but you got the problem of finding the plutonium. There are far less breeder reactors than there were back in the 80s and the 90s.
Duly noted. I don't know what to say about that, but I'm just trying to discuss how it works, not how you get the raw materials.
Okay. Okay, let me see what happened here. Very good. Yeah. Could very well be that system, but it's going to have to be, I mean, really refined, because the present system, they're just getting 109 watts out of it max. This thing's getting 10 kilowatts. I mean, you know, my generator for the house is 4 kilowatts. I mean, this thing's going to be putting out a 2.5 times the amount of what I could put out for my house. Just for one, they're going to have 40 things sitting on the moon. Very refined. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
No, I'm fine. I put in my 2 cents worth. It seems to be a much more efficient variation on an RTG. More than enough power for astronauts, but to generate the amount of fuel needed to go any place, you would probably need a few million of them running for a few centuries.
Very good. I'm going to research the crusty system. There's got to be more up on this. I mean, my data is probably a couple of years old, 2-3 years old. Maybe they gave up with the idea by now. I don't know. But we will research it further. They're going to have to do something because, like you said, Roy, you can't lay out a couple of football fields of solar panels to create all this power that they're going to need for a base on the moon. Never mind an electrolysis process. Okay, I just want to mention the Russian spacecraft talked about last week has docked with the International Space Station successfully on the Zvezda port. Correction, on the Pringle port. It's the south, it's the Earth-facing port on the Russian side, on one of their modules. And that's where the crew of three got out, Marina Valenskaya, and she's from anyway, it's the one that's an ally with Russia. Think of it. I talked about it last week. Anyway, Oleg Novoskoski, he's the commander. He flies this thing. But astronaut Tracy Dyson, she went up for a third trip. Anyway, it's successfully docked, and they're doing well. They joined the other 7 people, and that is 10 people on board that space station. Then there's another 3 flying around on the Chinese space station, so on a regular basis, we have 13 people now flying in space. And a week or two from now, 3 will return from the space station on another Soyuz craft, bringing that number back down to 7. That's the normal group that flies on the space station. That number goes up and down as time goes on, but the standard number is 7. Belarus, by the way, is the country I'm trying to think of. One of Putin's friends. Any comments? Okay. The Starliner has finally gotten an actual date to fly, May 1st. Starliner is built by Boeing. That's the one that competed with SpaceX years ago. Who was going to get to the International Space Station first, the Starliner by Boeing or Dragon Crew by SpaceX? SpaceX won out probably, what, a little over 4 years ago now. They've made around, let's see, 8 missions for NASA to the space station. And 2 additional private missions, so that's a total of 10. Plus the other one where they went into orbit but didn't go to the space station. That was the Inspiration 4 mission. When they raised all that money for the St. Jude Hospital, like $200 million for that donation. That was all hyped up. But, they apparently did raise enough money to get to that hospital. So that's 11 missions so far, crewed missions. Where the Starliner hasn't made one. It's made 2 flights. One tried to get to the space station, didn't make it. They did not have a crew on that. That was the first flight. The second flew, Starliner that went to... the second one also went on an Atlas V that flew to the International Space Station and did dock. First one didn't make it. Second one did. They actually had people go and see spacecraft when it was docked to the space station, check everything out. And then it flew back and landed on ground, on solid ground in White Sands, New Mexico. That's going to be the big difference between the 2 spacecraft, Starliner and Dragon. Starliner will land on the ground, and SpaceX has to land his crew in the water. They usually come down in the Gulf of Mexico or sometimes the Atlantic Ocean. Coming back on solid ground is going to be a big plus for NASA and the scientists. They get everybody back, including the scientific stuff, experiments that they're bringing back. They can have it right away instead of waiting for the transportation of the crew and from Dragon to shore. So we're looking forward to the flight of Starliner May 1st. WS2S. Okay, and the Euclid spacecraft, I read about it last week. I was going to talk about it. I never got to it. But this week I'll get to it. The Euclid spacecraft is out at the L2 location, 1 million miles away from Earth. It's out with the James Webb Space Telescope, same location. It's out with Gaia. Gaia is the European Space Agency telescope that's been out there for years. And you have Euclid, also a European Space Agency telescope. And it's been functioning okay, but then all of a sudden it started to haze up. There was like very fine mist that wound up on the lens. It's a 4-foot lens. It's moisture. It's H2O, and it's molecules thick.
That's time.
But
complete.
Naturally froze. So it does have a sun shield. The lens is facing away from the sun. It runs on near-infrared light, so it needs to be very cold. So whatever moisture was there somehow accumulated on the lens. Been out of commission for a while. The engineers figured out a way to heat this up to some degree, and now they've developed a procedure in case it happens again. They know what to do to correct it. But for a while there, they thought they could have a serious problem, having a lens with the, they said molecules stuck very, very thin, but enough to change the light that's coming in. So it's one of these things that looks at all the galaxies and looks at everything. Well, it's got a spectrometer, it's got a photometer on board, and it's able to the certain detections that no other telescope could do, not even the James Webb Space Telescope. So the scientists are glad to find out Euclid is back online. Anyway, any questions? I'm looking at the time. We're already up to 11 o'clock. WS2N. Okay. I won't continue on. I just want to mention one more. Rocket is finally come to an end. The Delta IV and the Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV Heavy was scheduled to go up a couple of days ago. They had some problems with some nitrogen pumps, not on the rocket, but on the ground side. So they scrubbed that launch. It will be the final launch of the Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV Heavy is literally heavy. It's much bigger than Falcon 9, for instance. The Falcon 9 Heavy. But this thing has flown 12 different times over the years. It was responsible for launching the Parker probe around the sun. Yeah, it's done a lot of missions for the Defense Department, for the National Reconnaissance Office. But it's done a couple of science missions as well. It was the one that they launched the first Orion spacecraft on in 2014. And that flight we covered here on the net. They went all the way out to like 3,000 miles above the surface of the Earth and then came back and reignited the second stage coming back toward Earth. This way they could accelerate it up to 20,000 miles an hour, where they could test the heat shield. That was the main goal of the first flight of Orion. That was way back then. It took all these other years, and 2022 in December they launched the first actual Orion spacecraft that could put a crew in. They could have put a crew in there, but that was the one that went around the moon and returned safely after 25 days. Now we're waiting for Artemis 2, which will have the same craft, the Orion spacecraft with a crew of four. But when that goes up, they have a predicted date of 2 Septembers from now. So we got a long way to go for that. And that one will orbit the moon, come back. That's still not the one that will land on the moon. First one to land on the moon will be theoretically a year after that. So I'm guessing maybe no earlier than 2027 for a moon landing. Anyway, let me drop it. Thank Roy for letting me do all this for the SpaceNet report. We'll turn it back to Roy. And happy Easter, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. Hopefully tomorrow. I got a birthday tomorrow. We'll see. We'll see if I make it on for the club net. Back to you, Roy. WS2F.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for all that you do with the SpaceNet report, for the technical net, all that you do for the club. Everyone appreciates it. I especially appreciate it. And an early happy birthday. I know I'm 56, 55 and a half minutes early, but I wish you a happy birthday. And thanks for everyone who showed up tonight. I hope you had fun. I hope you learned a few things. And I hope you'll join us next week. As I always do, I'll remind you of Dick K2RIW's closing comments for his technical net. Be kind to each other. That's really important these days. Try and be as kind as you can to people. Friend, enemy, stranger. Also, good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So please keep an open mind. It's good to be a bit skeptical because, if your mind is too open, your brain can fall out. But keep it open. Be willing to hear the other guy's comments. And if it makes sense, great. If they don't make sense, it makes for a good interaction. So our rebels now are done, people. I wish you a great week. Happy Easter. Have a safe and easy week. And please come back next week to join us for our next attempt at doing this. And as I always do these days, I will go clear with the closing statement, Slava Ukraine.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Repeater.
W2VL Repeater.
Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Repeater.
W2VL Repeater.
Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Repeater.
W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Repeater.
W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Repeater.
W2VL Repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Repeater.
W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater.
W2VL Repeater.
Skymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
And choose that you see mobile listening. ABC, Whiskey Alpha 6, Alpha Bravo, Charlie, Rockaway Beach, happy belated Easter.